The little 2-year-old yodeling cowboy, Charles Edwards. Honey, say good morning to all the little boys and girls.
On Sunday, July 20th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will remember bassist, composer, and former yodeling cowboy, Charlie Hayden. Sugar in My Bowl met with Charlie and his wife, Ruth Cameron, in 2011. That's Sunday, July 20th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. As mentioned, coming up next on Sugar in My Bowl, a rebroadcast of a program with Charlie Hayden and Ruth Cameron Hayden. My name's Joyce Jones. We'll be hearing from the bandstand at the bottom of the hour, so stay tuned. Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl. And I have on the line Charlie Hayden and Ruth Cameron Hayden.
I go by Ruth Cameron, and Ruth Cameron Hayden is private.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here, Charlie Hayden.
Okay.
Esquire. Charlie Hayden Esquire.
Actually, since I have you both on the line, could someone tell me how long you've been married?
Well, believe it or not, I think we can. We've been together since 1984, and we got married in 1989, 22 years now.
Okay.
And we got married in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, New Year's Eve, 1989.
Oh.
And the Liberation Music Orchestra was playing at the Village Vanguard for New Year's Eve.
We got married in the afternoon, and Charlie played at the Vanguard that night.
Oh, wow, that's perfect.
A perfect jazz situation.
Yes.
Good morning, friends. Howdy, howdy, everybody, everywhere. The Hayden children, Carl Jr., 13 with his guitar, who sings the baritone, Mary Elizabeth, 11 with her mandolin, who sings the lead, little Jimmy, 7 years old, who sings the high tenor, and last but not least, the little 2-year-old yodeling cowboy, Charles Edward. Honey, say good morning to all the little boys and girls. Say hello, all you little boys and girls. Say, I'm just fine.
I'm fine.
Just fine. And say, I've got a brand new song to sing for you this morning. This morning. There you are. All right. Little Charlie has had so many, many requests to sing that dandy little song, Row Us Over the Tide. And then Mama's going to take him out and get his big bottle of soda pop. So you sing real loud and nice here and a nice yodel. All right. Friend, that was little 2-year-old cowboy Charles Edwards singing Roll Us Over the Tide and Yodeling.
So let's go back in time, back, way back when, Charlie, you were playing with your family, playing a different type of music with your family.
Mm-hmm.
How did all that begin? How did they wind up having you do that?
My mom and dad were entertainers in country music before I was born. They had a group, my dad and my mother and another musician, and they traveled all over the Midwest to different radio stations and did their radio show. My dad was a really good MC and a great harmonica player and a good country singer. He played guitar, and my mother sang. As each one of my brothers and sisters were born, as soon as they were old enough, they were added to the family band, and pretty soon it became known as the Hayden family, and they went to this big 50,000 watt radio station, which is that was before television. And so when I was born, I was added to the show. When I was 22 months old, my mother was rocking me to sleep one day, and she was humming an old song, country song, and I started humming the harmony with her. And when I started humming the harmony, she told me the story because I don't remember it. But anyway, she said that as soon as I started singing the harmony with her, she knew I was ready for the radio show. So I started singing with the family when I was 22 months old, and that was my early musical education, learning how to sing all the harmony parts by ear and harmonizing with my brothers and sisters and my parents. And we did this, every day of the week.
You had 2 shows a day, huh?
2 shows a day. Mm. And, then when I was 15, I got the bulbar polio, which was, there was an epidemic that year, and they had no vaccine, and it paralyzed the muscles to my throat and my vocal cords and part of my face. And so I wasn't able to sing anymore, and I devoted all my energy into playing because I love jazz and I used to play my older brother's jazz records that he kept in his room, and when he left the house, I would play his bass with the records, and that's all I thought about was just playing with Charlie Parker, and so that was my goal, and here I am.
So did you inherit the bass after your brother left home?
No, I don't think so. He kept the bass with him.
Okay.
When my dad retired from the entertainment world, and he was a bass player where we had our last show. It was a television show in Omaha, Nebraska, and this was when TV first started, and he kept his bass with him, and he was playing different gigs with different bands, and then I got my grandmother to buy me a plywood bass, and I started playing on it, and then I played different times the high school basses that were in whatever high school that I happened to be in, and sometimes I played in the orchestras of the high school, and all along I was just trying to find a way to, you know, to make sure that I got to do what I wanted to do, which was play great music.
Now, when you were playing in high schools, were you playing what is known as jazz?
I mean, I was listening to records. I heard Charlie Parker play on a recording and really loved the intervals and the harmonies that he was playing. And you know, when you really think about it and listen to country music has a lot of beautiful harmony and chords and voicings. You know, they're the two art forms that come from the United States. And
sure.
They're both very, very beautiful harmonically and melodically. So I was drawn to jazz. It was a little deeper harmony for me, and I loved it. And then I saw Charlie Parker play at a concert in Omaha, and Billie Holiday was singing. I think I was 13 or 14. And then I saw Stan Kenton band come through Springfield, Missouri, which is where we moved back to, and I went to a concert they were playing, and I met the musicians. There's a whole part of the documentary that film that Swiss Television made about my life called Ramblin' Boy, and in the documentary I tell that story about my dad taking me to the concert in Springfield, Missouri, and I asked him if I could go backstage, and he said no. He took me back, and I met some of the musicians, and they said, so you want to be a jazz musician? And I said, yeah. He said, come by the hotel, kid, and hang out with us, you know, and my dad shook his head no. And I said, man, come on, you know, you can wait outside for me in the car. And so we went to the hotel where they were staying. And he said, if you're not down in 20 minutes, I'm coming up there. So I went up on the elevator and went to their room and knocked on the door. And all the smoke came out of the room.
Mm.
I never smelled any smoke like that. And they all had, you know, whiskey and gin and vodka and all the
tables. Oh, boy.
They were in their undershirts and smoking whatever, and cigarettes too, and one of them said, so you want to be a jazz musician? And I said, yeah. And he said, look around the room, kid. So I said, what are you talking about? He said, just look at these guys. So I went to every face and looked at their faces, and the man there, I said to me, he said, do you want to end up like this? Said, yeah. That was the beginning.
I understood that three of your influences were Jimmy Blanton, Wilbur Ware, and Oscar Pettiford. Is that true?
Yeah, they were influences, as were Israel Crosby and Walter Page and Wellman Broad, and, you know, and I really love Paul Chambers, too.
Ah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
before he passed away, I was living in New York then.
So you wound up playing with, anybody and everybody in the beginning. Hampton Hawes, Art Pepper, Dexter Gordon. How did you wind up working with Ornette Coleman?
I was playing at a club in Los Angeles called the Hillcrest Club with a pianist named Paul Blade. And this club was in the black section of Los Angeles, was playing there every night, and this was a very famous club, you know, for musicians to come and listen to us. And they had jam sessions that went into the wee hours of the morning. And so on my night off one time, we had Mondays off, I went to this other club called The Hague in Hollywood, and Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker were playing, and I went in to listen to them, and this guy comes in and asks him if he can sit in. He had an alto saxophone with him. It was plastic, you know, and so they said yes, because I was way back in the back. The place was packed with people. We couldn't even move him. And so he got his horn up, and they started to play. And just as soon as he started to play, they asked him to stop. And so he packed his horn away and left. And I tried to catch him because, you know, when he started to play, the whole room lit up for me. I loved the way he sounded and the freedom that he was playing, mm-hmm. beautiful melodic lines. I tried to catch him, and he disappeared in the alley outside. And the next day when I went to work at the Hillcrest, I asked our drummer, Linda McGraw, who was from New York, and he was African-American, and I asked him, I said, man, I heard this guy play last night that I never heard anything like that in my life. It was so brilliant. And he said, was he playing a plastic horn? And I said, yeah. He said, that was Ornette Coleman. He said, I know him. I'll introduce you. Mm-hmm. So he brought him over to the Hillcrest to one of the after-hours jam sessions where I had to say, you know, from when we finished working at 2 in the morning, I had to say we had an hour or two-hour break, and then the jam session started and went until 9 in the morning. And I stayed in case no bass player showed up for the jam session. I had to play the whole night. So he brought him in. And he was sitting at a table near the bandstand, and he took me over and introduced us, and I said, I heard you play the other night, man. You sound so beautiful. And he said, thank you. He said, not many people tell me that. And he said, would you like to play? I said, yeah. He said, well, let's go over to my house. And I said, well, I have to stay here because I have to finish out the night here. I won't be able to leave until 9 in the morning, but I sure would love to go and play. So, you know, at 9, I left with him, and it was, like, really sunny outside, and people were going to church, and we went to his little Studebaker, and I put my bass in the car, and we went to this little apartment he had, and there was music everywhere, and I was scared to death, and he picked up a piece of music off the rug, and he said, let's play this, and I was scared to death, and we started playing. He said, now just play what you feel and what you hear from what I'm playing. He said, I'm going to be creating a new chord structure, the new chord changes. And you just follow me because all my chord changes are going to change. They're all going to be different. And just follow me.
Wow.
And so, you know, I was nervous, and it was like one of the greatest experiences of my life because I had been hearing to play that way before. There was no one to play music with that heard like that. It was almost like, you know, being born again for me And we played for hours and hours. I think we played into Monday morning and Monday night. And then, he invited me after a while to come over to Don Cherry's house to rehearse with them because they were starting a group and they wanted me to play bass. And the head of Atlantic Records, his name was Matthew Erdogan.
Mm-hmm.
He was the brother of Ahmet Erdogan.
Right.
And he really loved our music. And so we made a record called The Shape of Jazz to Come while we were still in L.A. And then we made another one called Change of the Century. And then one day Ornette told me, he said, we got a chance to go to New York and play at the Five Spot. Do you want to go? I said, are you kidding? So next thing I knew, I was on a plane. We were going to New York City. And it was just wonderful.
Now, Billy Higgins was in that group as well, right?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
I actually played a lot with Billy and Don Cherry before I met Ornette. We were playing different little gigs around L.A., and Cherry would be playing piano.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we had a little trio, but I was also at the same time playing with a lot of different musicians at different clubs. And there was so much music going on in L.A. then.
Mm.
It was kind of like 52nd Street was in New York, you know?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. Well, I know he came from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Twice. He came once and then went back to Texas and then he came back.
Okay.
That's when I met him. And and I know, if you can name me a jazz musician that has any money, I'll make you a bet you can't. he was a freight elevator operator at Bullock's department store.
Oh.
And that gave him enough money to pay his rent and make a living a little bit. And but he got fired because he started practicing and he was not going to the floors that were ringing the bell. he would be waiting for, 10, 15 minutes and he would never come. So the guy, Mr. Bullock, I guess, fired him.
Oh, okay. I've read that you were with Ornette Coleman between 1958 through 1960. I guess that's more consistently. But it seems as though you spent a lot of years together, off and on, in between other projects.
Oh, yeah. No, we played together so much. And we had different quartets and different configurations. I played with his first band.
Mm-hmm.
From about 1957 until after the Five Spot, we made this recording called Double Quartet with Eric Dolphy and Freddie Hubbard and Scotty LaFaro and I and Ed Blackwell and Billy. And this was in 61. He kind of laid off for a minute there. I guess he wanted to get some things together and to write some new music. And so during this time, I was playing with a lot of different people. And then when I came back to play with him again, he had a trio with David Isenson and Charles Moffett playing drums, and David Isenson was the bass player.
Right, right.
And I came back to New York, and he asked me, you know, I want to add you back into the trio, so I'll have two bass players. So we started doing that. You know, this was about the same time that we made this album with Bernardo, his son.
I was just going to ask you about that, the empty foxhole.
Yeah, the empty foxhole. DiNardo was 9 years old.
Oh, okay.
You
yes.
know, and he asked me one day, he said, I want you to come and rehearse with me and DiNardo, man. And it was down in the village, 12-flight walk-up. I had to climb 12 flights
wow.
to the base.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I got up there, and here was his 9-year-old kid behind the drum. And
how did you feel about that?
Well, you know, anything that would enable me to play with Ornette, I was down for it.
Okay.
Whatever could take me to him, I would do, because you know, I mean, if they asked me to play with Guy Lombardo and it was a chance to play with Ornette, I would do it. You know. So. That was the most important thing to me.
For those who may not know, Guy Lombardo had, what was it, a sort of big band sound and very traditional. One of his major songs was Auld Lang Syne during New Year's Eve.
Yeah, that was his signature piece.
Right. So did you talk to DiNardo about your playing as a child, your singing and performing as a child?
Oh, they all knew about my background.
Okay.
You know, Ornette came from country music too, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what really drew him to my playing, because I was kind of like a self-taught natural musician, and I played really close to the way he was hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were writing tune with each other from the very beginning, and it remains that way even today when I go to New York and I play. I just played in New York with the quartet at Birdland, and I go over to his house and he's playing, you know, and it's amazing.
Speaking of playing with someone for a long time, you have these long relationships
with musicians like Keith Jarrett, Pat Metheny. The list is endless. Oh, Paul Mosher.
Mm-hmm.
How did you wind up? Okay, maybe we'll just run it down. Who do we start with? Paul Motion? Should we start with him? How did you wind up playing with him?
Well, I started playing with Paul. I met him when I was playing at the Five Spot in 1959 with Ornette and Don Cherry and Billy Higgins. He was across town at the Village Vanguard. Mm. We were on the east side, and the Vanguard was on the west, in the West Village. And whenever they would get a break, intermission, Paul Motion would bring Scotty over. Because Bill Evans and Scotty and Paul were playing at the Vanguard.
This Scott LaFaro?
Scott LaFaro. Okay. We were very, very close friends. We were like brothers. He was staying at my apartment in L.A. when I first met him. He came and lived in my place, and we became inseparable friends. And and then when we both went to New York together, we stayed in really close contact, and he was coming over to the Five Spot a lot, and that's when I met Paul Motion. And then when I started playing in the trio of Keith, this was like 1967, and I was playing at a club in the East Village called The Dawn with Tony Scott, and Keith used to come in and sit in with us playing soprano, and I didn't really know about his piano playing. And then one night he came and he was playing soprano, and he said, I'm starting a trio, and I want you to play bass. Could you come over to my house? And I came to his house, and a soprano wasn't even going to be singing, he was playing piano. And so we had our first rehearsal, and we made several records as a trio, and it's one of the best trios that ever played. I don't know if you ever heard those records, but the first one was called Life Between the Exit Signs.
WBAI, New York.
Ornette sent for Dewey to come and play with us. he wanted to change, you know, from Don Cherry to Dewey Redmond. So we were all playing at the same time. It was really a music scene that was unbelievable. I was playing with Keith, and I was playing with Ornette's band, and then I was just starting the Liberation Music Orchestra, the first record that we did about Vietnam, and Carla Bray wrote the arrangements, and
right.
So all that was going on at the same time, so I didn't have very much time to do anything else but play.
Wow. So how did you wind up playing with John Coltrane?
John Coltrane used to come in the five spot every night to hear us play.
Okay.
When we first started there, he would sit in the front table by himself mostly and listen, and then we would hang out a little bit, and then he would grab Ornette's by the arm, and they would go off into the night and talk about whatever. And then I got a call from John saying that he wanted me to make a record with him, which I did. And that was such a beautiful experience to get to know him. And later I became really close with Alice.
Yes.
We were very close friends.
And you recorded with Alice as well.
Many records.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to insert this really quickly because, as you can see, I'm not able to play a lot of the songs because Charlie had a lot to say, Charlie Hayden. This is Joyce Jones on Sugar in My Bowl, rebroadcasting a show that we aired on with Charlie Hayden. Charlie Hayden, rest in peace. This is The Blessing, John Coltrane and Don Cherry, The Avant-Garde, Atlantic, 1966. Before that, we heard Keith Jarrett, Life Between the Exit Signs, Atlantic, 1967. Lisbon Stomp was the name of the song. Before that, we heard The Empty Foxhole with Ornette Coleman, the title track, Blue Note, 1966. Before that, we heard Free Jazz, Part 2, Ornette Coleman, Double Quartet. And before that, we heard, eventually, Ornette Coleman, The Shape of Things to Come, Atlantic Records. Before that, we heard Round About Midnight, Miles Davis, and Prestige, 1958. Before that, we heard The Old Hayden Family Show, and that's where you heard the two-year-old Yodeling Cowboy, Charles Edward. And before that, we opened the show with Today I Am a Man. That is from Sophisticated Ladies, the Charles Hayden Quartet West, 2011 Decca Records. And don't have a lot of time, so we're going to continue to listen to the rest of The Blessing. And the playlist should be up on sugarinmybowl.org. Should be up. And, excuse me, last week's playlist will be there as well with Bobby Sinabria Part 2. So stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Charlie Hayden. And on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Well, back to the other long relationships you have, Pat Metheny.
Mm.
Now, eventually you wound up doing, was it Beyond the Missouri Sky?
Yeah.
Yes. What is the subtitle?
Short story.
My partner, Hank, wanted to know, from where do you get the stories? What are the short stories?
That was part of the title of the record, and I suppose the short stories were the songs.
Okay. Okay.
And we did all these Americana kind of songs. And, you know, I met Pat way before that. He did an album called 8081 with Michael Brecker and I and Jack DeJohnette and Stewie Redman. And
yes.
That was on UCM, and that's when we first met, and we became really close friends.
Okay, just want to let you know what you're hearing right now is Song X, Pat Metheny, Ornette Coleman. Song X, that's 1993 Geffen Records. Yeah, I should have had 8081, but I don't. I do, but I didn't include it here. So, before that, we heard Alice Coltrane from Translinear Light, Impulse Records 2004. This Train is the name of that song that was played. And the playlist is indeed up on sugarinmybowl.org. Sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl.org. Just look for playlists and it'll be there, as will the playlist for last week. That'll be on the way. And let's see, we're going to play Waltz for Ruth, which was written by Charlie Hayden after this, and Not in Our Name, which was also written by Charlie Hayden with the Liberation Music Orchestra. Waltz for Ruth will be from Beyond the Missouri Sky. But after Not in Our Name, you will be hearing from the bandstand. We'll be hearing On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams. And then we'll go into the second hour with more Liberation Music Orchestra.
and more Charlie Hayden. And we'll eventually hear from Ruth Hayden some more. I mean, Ruth Cameron, excuse me. Ruth Cameron. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of this show. My name's Joyce Jones. Stay tuned. Something currently with Keith Jarrett. Jasmine?
That's right, yeah. It's the first time we played together when we did Jasmine in 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Pat, you know, we play a lot of different concerts together with his band, and then we were talking one day, and he said, you know, we should do a duet, and I said, well, I've been wanting to do that with you because of all these country tunes, and we started making a list of tunes, and he would call me. He was living in New York, and I was living at that time back in L.A., and we would call each other, and he would go over whatever he was hearing with me, and vice versa, and before you knew it, we had a record together, and it became Beyond the Missouri Sky. It was a very beautiful record, and I guess it got a Grammy and a lot of other awards, and it's a classic.
Sure. Congratulations. I'm glad you won a Grammy. They recognize, the industry recognized the both of you.
Oh, yeah.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for July 20th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's show is a memorial tribute to the late, great bassist Charlie Hayden, but we have an expanded set of live music listings for you this week. There are several opportunities to catch bassist Mimi Jones. She'll be leading a band at The Lion on the 20th, and at the Village Vanguard from July 22nd to 27th with drummer Rudy Royston's sextet. See thelionnyc.com for the show on the 20th and villagevanguard.com for the shows there. Drummer Bobby Sanabria will be appearing as part of the orchestra in a free performance of Larry Harlow's Omi, a Latin opera, at Lincoln Center's Out of Doors series on July 23rd. He'll also be leading a band at Jazzmobile's Grant's Tomb concert on July 30th. Information for the Lincoln Center show is at lcoutofdoors.org. That's lcoutofdoors.org. And for details on the Grant's Tomb concert, go to jazzmobile.org. Trombonist Steve Turay appears at the Jazz Standard from July 24th to 27th with saxophonist Donald Harrison's quintet. Go to jazzstandard.com for details. And you can also catch him in an afternoon set at the Carrimore Jazz Festival on the 27th. See carrimore.org for details. That's CARAMOOR.org. Blueswoman Alexis P. Suter is at Iridium on the 25th and has a free outdoor concert in Cold Spring, New York on the 27th. Details are at theiridium.com and coldspringliving.com for the show there. Saxophonist Tia Fuller leads a quartet at Jazz at Lincoln Center on the 29th and 30th. See jalc.org for details. Pianist Vijay Iyer drops by The Stone for a late set on August 1st. See thestonenyc.com for information. Guitarist Pat Metheny appears at Carrimore in Westchester County with his Unity Group on August 2nd. See carrimore.org for info. And looking ahead, pianist Jerry Allen has a solo performance at the Oscar Schindler Performing Arts Center in West Orange, New Jersey on August 2nd. See njai.org for info. That's njai.org. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Suge and My Bowl blog. Go to sugeandmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. You can help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can or becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge to WBAI Radio. Click on the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off the WBAI airwaves next week for the last Sunday of the month, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, August 3rd. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Thank you, Hank Williams. And yes, we will be back August 3rd. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl. And this is a memorial broadcast of a show that originally aired in 2011.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Back to the Liberation Music Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. How did it start? And how did you and Carla Bley, you know, say, okay, let's do this?
Well, I knew Carla from when I was playing at the Hillcrest in L.A., which is like 1956, 57. She was married to Paul Bley, mm-hmm. and we became friends. And I knew her music, and I knew the way she composed and the way she arranged her instruments. And as growing up in the Ozarks is a very racist part of the country. And then after I left, I found out that almost every place in the country was racist, so I wasn't in the only place, but I didn't like where I was living. And I felt injustice all around me, and I grew up with that inside me, and I got out of Missouri as soon as I could and went to L.A., but it was kind of a political awakening for me. I was introduced to a lot of injustice in the world, not just in the States, but everywhere. So when Vietnam was happening, I was listening to WBAI. I was playing at a little club on Midtown in, on 39th and Lexington. And I was on a break, and I was listening to WBAI in my car. And Nixon had just bombed Cambodia. And I couldn't believe what was going on. And I decided, you know, I had a collection of songs, political songs, from all different parts of the world, you know, and different countries in South America. You know, the people united will never be defeated. I had all those songs from Caribbean and Chile and Bolivia. And I also had a lot of songs from the Spanish Civil War. And so I got this idea to make a record to voice my concerns about what was going on. And I called Carla Bley, and I said, I want to do this record in protest of what's happening in And maybe you could write the arrangements for me. So we got together, and I played her some of the music, and I composed some of the music, and she composed some more music. And before we knew it, we had a great record together, and we hired these great musicians in New York: Roswell Rudd playing trombone, and Don Cherry playing trumpet, and Dewey Rhythm playing tenor, and Arthur Barbieri playing tenor, and mm-hmm. Paul Motion playing drums, and Carla playing piano, and there were 12 musicians in the Liberation Music Orchestra, and they were all master improvisers. And we made this record called the Liberation Music Orchestra. And, you know, it became a really an underground success all over the world. And then the next record we did was under Reagan, and it was called The Ballad of the Fallen. And then we made another record under George Bush's father mm-hmm. called Dreamkeeper.
Yes, and that one has Ken McIntyre on it.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And then we did Not in Our Name, mm-hmm. Which is the latest one about, you know, I don't even want to talk about it. Well, you know, it's the corrupt and greedy family of the Bushes and all the people they were surrounded by, all the corporate CEOs and people who were making so much money from Wall Street and wars and whatever else they could manufacture so they could make more and more money. And so we did an album called Not in Our Name. And that's the last one we recorded. I'm thinking about doing another one now because, you know, I think maybe I'll do another record.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because it's definitely necessary.
You think so?
I think so. Especially with the most recent Libya situation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, in Wisconsin.
Exactly. There's always a reason to have a liberation music.
Yeah, more and more people are becoming aware, you know, of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad what's going on. And it's really good that more and more people are becoming aware of what's going on because the people in Wisconsin, you know, started protesting. And I thought it was such a wonderful thing that that could happen in the United States, that people were together and camaraderie and they were staying, you know, and speaking in tents and, mm-hmm. you know, wanting their voices to be heard. It was really something to see.
Yeah, it was definitely a beautiful scene, people coming out, making their voices heard. Well, speaking of making your voice heard, I understood you were arrested in Portugal when you were performing with Ornette Coleman. You want to tell us about that?
It was a tour that happened in 1971. My triplet daughters had just been born, and Ornette had this opportunity to go to Europe with the Newport Jazz Festival. So he told me and Blackwell, Ed Blackwell and Billy Redman that he wanted to do this tour. And I guess, you know, Miles Davis's band was on the tour, and Keith Jarrett actually was playing electric piano with him on that tour, so we got to hang out a lot. And then Duke Ellington's band was playing, and, you know, I got to meet a lot of guys in Duke's band and hang out with Paul Gonzalez. And then the Giants of Jazz is another band that was on the tour. That was Thelonious Monk and Art Blakey and Al McKibben and Kay Linding and Sonny Stitt.
Wow.
And, oh, man, what a band that was.
Wow.
And we were all traveling together, you know, and what a trip. I mean, I'll never forget that tour.
I bet.
So, you know, we were playing in Portugal. I saw on the itinerary, I wasn't going to go on the tour because my daughters had just been born and I wanted to stay and help, you know, because they were triplets. And boy, that's a lot of work.
So, right.
Anyway, I decided that I should go and try to make a little money to help in that way. And when I got the itinerary, I saw the last country. There were 14 countries in Portugal, and I didn't agree with the colonial policies of Portugal, the colonies that they had in Africa. They were systematically wiping out the black race, and I went to Ornette's hotel room. Well, first, even before we left New York, I called him and I said, I really don't want to play in Portugal. And he said, why? And I told him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we signed a contract. Don't worry. Everything will be all right. Just get on the plane. So we got to the first country and we had a little meeting in the hotel. And he said, you got to play, man. And I said, well, he said, think of something you can do. And so I decided to, Ornette, on this particular tour, was playing one of my songs. He always plays just his music when he tours and records. It's always Ornette's music. And in this case, he wanted to do the song that I wrote for Che Guevara called Song for Che because he really liked it. And so we played it on every concert. And because we were playing my song, and he said, you know, do whatever you want to do. So I decided when we played my song, before we played it, I would dedicate it. When we got to Portugal, I decided to dedicate it to the Black People's Liberation Movement in Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau. I was arrested and put into the political prison in the PID, and it was a very scary situation. But anyway, I'm glad I did it.
Did they question you? Did they do anything?
Well, they were questioning me very, you know, aggressively. A couple of them had truncheons in their hand, ready to hit me, where they could hit me without leaving a mark. So, needless to say, I was very scared, and this went on for a couple of days, and probably the next day, well, they wanted me to sign the statement that he had written out in Portuguese, and I said, I can't read it. They said, well, Mr. Hayden, you should sign it. You got yourself into this mess. You got to sign this, and, you know, you shouldn't mix politics with music. And, I wanted to call the embassy. Then before I knew what was happening, the guy who was controlling the questioning kind of changed expressions and said, you're a very lucky man. The United States embassy has just sent over the cultural attaché. They're going to retrieve you. And I said, fantastic.
Do you know how that came about, or it just happened and you were glad?
I was glad, and I think Ornette had something to do with the calling the embassy. And I think when they went on to London, and I had to stay and listen, but I think when he got to London, he pulled some strings and got me out.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I understood the FBI interviewed you once you got back.
Mm-hmm. Several times. We became buddies.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, by then. To listen to the, you know, I said, you guys like jazz? They said, well, we haven't listened to that much. I said, sit down, you know. And I played so much jazz for them, I think they didn't want to come back. So that's how I got rid of them.
Thank you.
So tell me about the Montreal tapes. I mean, there are a series of recordings. One of them was a tribute to Joe Henderson.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Montreal tapes were actually a tribute to me.
Oh, okay.
Where they wanted me to play seven nights with seven different people that I had recorded and played with over my career.
Right.
And so I chose Blackwell and Don Cherry and on one concert, and Joe Henderson and Al Foster on one concert,
right.
And another concert, Advantages Monty, another concert, Gonzalo Rubalcaba,
right.
Another one was Jerry Allen.
Yes.
And Paul Motion played drums on many of the concerts,
exactly.
And the Liberation Music Orchestra played one of the concerts. And
yes, I have several of them.
Yeah, Pat Metheny and Jack DeJohnette played one of the concerts with me.
Mm.
And they all pretty much were released at the Montreal tapes afterwards. And I think that they have been released in a box set, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was great. That was a great celebration. How'd you feel about that?
I felt very honored that they would do that. And you know, what a treat for me. I got to play with all these people 7 nights.
Jerry Allen.
I met Jerry Allen through, I think it was, anyway, it was Paul Motion.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to go to Cuba, and they wanted me to come. It was a last-minute kind of deal, and it was the jazz festival in Havana, and so I started calling a lot of different people because it was such a last-minute thing. A lot of people in that trade in the band were working, and I couldn't get Carla, and so I called Jerry, and she came and played with the orchestra. It was really something that she played so great that I thought, boy, this would be great to use Jerry and Paul and make a trio. And we got a trio together. We made about 4 records on different labels as Charlie and Jerry Allen, Paul Motion. It was really a great trio. She's a great player, you know, and a great person.
Do you know the pianist Vijay Iyer?
I know of him. I've never heard.
He seems to enjoy etudes. You know, he loves Jerry Allen, that he loves that particular recording.
Oh, well, he's got good taste.
Right. About Quartet West. Started in 1987, huh?
1986.
Okay.
Actually, my wife Ruth started the band because I was out of town a lot, and I met Ruth in 1984 here in L.A. when I came back to L.A. to be near my kids, and she was talking about, you know, you should get a band in L.A.
Well, Ruth should come into the conversation now. Ruth, are you there?
Well, I am.
Here
I am.
She is.
Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
So tell me how you met.
Well, actually, we met
through Flora Korean's sister, Yana. Yana was in Los Angeles. I was new to Los Angeles, as was Yana, and we met through a friend of ours, our mutual love of jazz. I was trying to make a living as an actor in Los Angeles, and Yana was trying to make a living as a singer, and our mutual friend was also actor-singer, and we all love jazz. And one day, Yana said, I'm staying at this place with Will, who owns the Comeback Inn, and Charlie Hayden's playing, and I want to have him on my record, and I want you to pretend you're my manager and get him to play my record. I said, no, but I have the car, you see. So I said, look, I'll drop you off at your meeting, and then I'll pick you up, because I am not going to pretend I'm your manager. But anyway, I had to call Charlie for directions, and he seemed like a very nice person and a lovely voice. And we met through Yana, and he asked me out, and the rest is history.
Oh, great.
So that was an L.A. story, 1984. And as far as Quartet West is concerned, it is quite true. Charlie, when he did have time off, which wasn't too often in L.A., he was at a loss, you know, thinking, gosh, I wish I had a band here. And I said, well, why don't you get a band? Billy Higgins is here. Mm. And he said, oh, yes. You know, I think you forget that you're living in the same town as a lot of musicians, because everyone meets each other on the road. Mm. They never see each other at home.
Right, right.
And he said, well, you're right. And also, he had just played me a solo by Ernie Watts on an album of Michelle Colombier's called Old Fool Back on Earth. And he loved that solo of Ernie's. And he said, you know, this guy, you know, plays so beautifully. And we had just seen him downtown at a concert at the Dorothy Chandler. Hmm. And I said, well, doesn't Ernie Watts live here? And he said, well, yeah.
Ernie Watts plays sax.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as far as pianists were concerned, we were on the freeway. This is a typical L.A. story. And listening to, at that time, I think it was called KKGO, the jazz station here. And Chuck Niles, who was a very well-known jazz disc jockey in L.A. And we heard the piano solo. And Charlie said, oh, who's that? And Chuck Niles said, well, this was Alan Broadbent from New Zealand. And we said, oh, that's too bad. He's from L.A. But we got off the freeway, and Charlie went to a payphone, you know, before cell phones.
Right.
So Alan is from New Zealand, and Chuck said, well, he actually lives in L.A. So that was kind of perfect. So Charlie called all the musicians and introduced himself, and I got them a gig at a club that no longer exists, but it was a nice club at the time called At My Place in Santa Monica. And for some reason, they all came from disparate parts of jazz. But when they started to play together, it just formed this really interesting sound. And they all appreciated music in the same way. It had the same musical values. And they're all really great people. And they formed this great band. And they've been together for 25 years.
Wow.
Billy passed away. And Lawrence Marable took over playing drums.
Okay.
And he's not been too well lately. And Rodney Green, who came to Charlie years ago and said, I want to play with you. Rodney's great. So,
and Rodney plays what?
Rodney Green plays drums.
This is starting to sound like Spinal Tap.
Yeah. And Rodney Green said, I'd always wanted to play with Charlie. And so Charlie called and said, okay, come on. And Rodney's just sounding just fantastic. You know, he's the baby in the band.
Oh, excellent. Oh, it's a wonderful recording. The most recent, Sophisticated Ladies. How did you come up with the concept?
Charlie.
We know the concepts of all of the records come from Ruth and I. She's the co-producer. She does so much. A lot of people don't realize how much she does and how much she contributes to everything musically and spiritually. And we play in New York at the Blue Note with Kenny Barron. And the executive producer of most of the Quartet West records was a guy in Paris named Jean-Philippe Allard. And
he was the producer for Abby Lincoln on Verve, yes?
Yeah, and a lot of other people. And then he left the producing aspect of the music and went into publishing. And he came in one night with Kenny Barron. I was playing, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about, we haven't worked together in so long. You made this great record with Hank Jones. you know, remember when they didn't steal away all the spirituals and hymns and folk songs? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we should do another one. You and Hank should do another record, and we should do another Quartet West record because, you know, we haven't recorded the quartet since this album called The Art of the Song, which was with strings and Shirley Horn sang and Bill Henderson sang. And I said, well, let's do it. So we were thinking about the concept, and both Ruth and I, we love singers. You know, one of my favorite singers is Jerry Southern, and I introduced Jerry Southern to Ruth, who started studying with Jerry. And so it's kind of like a singing family, too. You know, I mean, we all love singers. And we started to think about going beyond that, and Jean-Philippe was saying, why don't we do a record with all singers and your favorite singers and call it Sophisticated Ladies? And I said, boy, that sounds great. And so that's what we did. I called Diana Krall, who's a good friend, and we got in touch with Nora Jones, and we got in touch with all the singers on the record, Renee Fleming, Cassandra Wilson, mm-hmm. and Melanie Gardot, and Ruth, of course. I knew that she was going to sing on the record from the get-go.
I didn't.
No, really?
I know, because I figured I wouldn't make that decision.
Let us say it was just meant to be. Let's call it a day.
But all the other singers, both Charlie and I are big fans of. We love all of those singers, you know, the young contemporary singers. And as far as my participation on that from the musical side, I left that up to Charlie and Jean-Philippe, you know, and I just said it has to pass muster with them, otherwise I wasn't going to push it, but I'm very honored that they did allow me to be on the record. But as a producer, I was involved with all the other singers, you know, choosing which one. Big fan of Cassandra Wilson. Big fan of all of them, mm-hmm. Diana and Melody. They bring so much from today, and they're all very, very serious about their music, and they bring something new to the voice of the American songbook. And they're carrying on the tradition, and they're very serious about it. So we're big fans.
Well, Ruth, I have to admit that I know you've recorded before. I know you were even on Rambling Boy, which I will be playing bits of that at some point. But I have to admit that the first time I really listened to you was on Sophisticated Ladies, and I really, really enjoy how smooth your voice is. It's very. Sultry.
I'm very honored. Thank you very much. I come from theater, actually. Mm-hmm. So my perspective when I sing is to bring, you know, the meaning and truth to the lyric, as well as honoring the actual music, the notes. So, you know, that's my perspective. I like telling a story.
Yeah, I think all the great song stylists do like to tell stories.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and all of the singers were fans of Ruth, too, because she's got this really great record called Roadhouse, which is with Brad Meldow and Alan Brothers, and it's a beautiful, beautiful record.
Life's dreary for me. Days seem to be long as years. I look for the sun, but I see none through my tears. Your heart must be like a stone to leave me here all alone. When you could make my life worth living by simply taking what I'm set on giving. My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul.
You produced that, didn't you, Charlie?
Mr. Reed.
Okay.
He was my boss.
Yes.
On other records, I'm his boss.
Sophisticated Ladies, it just came out last month during Women's History Month. Yes?
Mm. That's right. You know, that's right.
March 22nd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was brand new.
The concept actually evolved. We had the concept of Sophisticated Ladies singing various songs. But what I noticed when we were sequencing was that there's a story that unfolds. It starts with Melody, who's the youngest singer, with her very hopeful approach to love and romantic ideal. And then there's Nora with a slightly, she's had a, you know, had to get over a few experiences with ill wind. Mm-hmm. And then it progresses from Cassandra's, you know, the deep, more mature love and mine, you know, a little bitter. And then Renee's wonderful rendition, you know, it's something very deep and passionate, and culminating with Diana saying goodbye.
Right, right.
Having been through it all. So I think it tells an interesting story, a different perspective on love.
And the vocal recordings are sprinkled with instrumentals throughout.
Wonderful instrumentals.
Yes.
I mean, it's a great band. And also, not to forget, Alan Broadbent's great arrangement.
Yes.
And everything was recorded live with the musicians and with the strings, with the exception of Cassandra's track and Renee's track, because we just couldn't get them to the studio while we were actually recording the strings live. But everybody else sang live to the music.
That's a rarity all by itself.
Yes, it is. And I'll tell you, each one of the singers were amazing. They were wonderful to work with, completely professional and prepared. They know what their sound is to be like. They know, you know, they were so helpful in listening back to the tracks and making sure that we had all the material we needed. Each one of them was just a gem, I have to say. We're in love with all of them.
Well, thank you, Decca Records, for getting this recording to me. Yay.
We're very fortunate that we have great friends in the recording industry that still support our music and support Charlie, and we thank them.
The last time we spoke, which was the first time we spoke, actually the first time I spoke to Charlie, was around Abby Lincoln and her transition.
Well, not only was she such a great singer, she was a great intellect and a great actress and a great personality. I had the fortune to hang out with her a couple of times, you know, throughout our relationship because she worked with Jean-Philippe and with Charlie on various occasions. And I always came away meeting her knowing that I had a greater experience. You know, she was just a marvelous person and a great broad.
Yeah.
And we could just hang out and talk about a lot of things. She was very, very bright and brilliant, really. Brilliant human being.
And a lot of people don't seem to realize how great of a writer she was. Composer and writer. You know, her words were really rich and...
Yeah. Poet.
Yes, exactly.
She put lyrics to the song that I wrote for Ruth, which was called First Song.
Yes.
She put lyrics to that.
Yeah. Really wonderful lyrics.
Really great lyrics.
When I did the special in October, I included that song, and I will certainly play it again tonight.
Great.
actually, I have a question with regard to Charlie and education. Mm-hmm. You created a program. You want to talk about that?
Well, I started the jazz studies at California Institute of the Arts in 1982. And I think it's one of the best programs in the country because it's really, the emphasis is on creativity and spirituality. It's not geared toward big bands and lab bands and studios. It's about creativity, which I'm really happy about. And so a lot of great people are teaching there, and we have students from all over the world. And the CalArts thing is a wonderful jazz studies, and it's, you know, there are jazz studies all over the country. You know, North Texas State and Berklee College of Music in Boston. And they're all good, but this is very special.
So how does the program work? How does it, how is it broken down?
Well, I mean, we have classes in music theory and the history of jazz and in arranging and composing. It's just like pretty much every other jazz study, except it's about spirituality and about improvisation and finding your own voice. My class especially is around the spirituality of improvisation.
Hmm.
It's not very often talked about it in most jazz studies. It's mostly about, you know, the technical part of music, and it's not geared around what happens when you improvise.
Interesting. That sounds exciting, actually. And I hope other people who are in that area are able to take full advantage of that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And I've been teaching it every Tuesday for 27 years.
Wow. Excellent. Now, Rambling Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know about it, but tell the listeners about Rambling Boy. Tell them how you decided to do this and how you got your friends to join you.
Well, you know, I'm interested in all real music from the heart. You know, I've recorded with Dino Cellucci in Argentina. I've recorded with Egberto Gismonti in Brazil. I've recorded with the fado player Carlos Paredes in Lisbon. I've recorded many different kinds of music. I made a Grammy winning blues album with James Cotton. I've just played on Ringo Starr's new record. I've played on many different people of many different genres, and so I'm interested in all different kinds of music. And my daughters and my son are very talented. I have triplet daughters, like I said before, and my son Josh and Rachel, Petra, and Tanya. So they were all surrounded by country music too when they were growing up, because we have a lot of music from my family. And many different times, Pat Metheny has asked me about when you're going to do a country record. And Ruth has always been trying to get me to do it. And so one year when I won a Grammy, one of the Grammys, I can't remember which one.
It's always nice when you could say one of the Grammys, I can't remember which one.
Yeah. I was backstage, you know, doing press, and this guy came up to me and he said, I'm Mark Fain, I'm the bass player with Ricky Skaggs. And he said, I've got every jazz record you've ever made, and I'm your biggest fan. But he said, I also know your country background. And if you ever want to do a country record, just let me know, because I know everybody in Nashville.
Oh.
And so I took him up on it, and we all went to Nashville. And, you know, Mark came to L.A., and we got the girls and Josh and Ruth in the living room, and we started going over these old tunes that my parents used to sing. And it sounded good, man. I was a little nervous because I'd never done that before, you know, since I got out of the country music stuff. And when we got to Nashville and I heard everybody sing, I was so happy. They were really into it, and they brought their heart and soul into the realm of old-fashioned folk songs from the United States, which, you know, used to be called hillbilly music.
Mm-hmm.
It was called, you know, country music, fiddling music. You know, when I was raised in the Ozarks, man, they used to play the fiddle, the violin on their chest. And so I wanted to do a record using the songs that we used to do, that the Carter family used to do, that the Delmore brothers used to do, that the Sammy brothers did. I'm talking about the old country music.
Right.
And, country music nowadays is pop.
Right.
Single girls, stone and dry.
speaking of the Carter family, your triplets do single girl, married girl.
Yeah.
Love that. Love that.
Yeah, that's a good one there.
Yeah.
That was women's liberation.
Right.
Back in the day.
Right, exactly. Now, you said that you sat around, you and the family sat around and chose which songs you were going to perform?
Well, you know, I guess I'm the main guy in that because I sang all those songs with my family. So I have all the music, and I went through all the music and decided which music would be good to do.
You were called a singing cowboy, weren't you?
I was called Cowboy Charm. Yodeling Cowboy Charm. My dad used to say, and here he is, folks. Yodeling Cowboy Charles Edwards. I never wanted to say my middle name, you know, Edward, but he did.
That's a very good name. I have a brother named Edward.
Oh, man.
Well, this is a beautiful picture of you on the back of Ramblin' Boy, too.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Everyone needs to get this just for that, just for the lovely photo. But no, it's actually, I love the music.
Yeah, I think he looks like little Lord Fauntleroy in that.
He does, with his little Lord Fauntleroy pants, riding pants.
It's a beautiful red velvet suit.
Yes. Oh, yeah, it's a wonderful recording. And Ruth, you sing on this as well?
I do.
Down by the Sally God. My love and I did meet. She crossed the Sally Gardens with little snow-white feet. She bid me take the leaves grow on the tree, but I was young and foolish, and with her did not agree.
I chose that song.
Oh,
because I'm you know, Gaelic, Gaelic extraction, and I felt that I wanted to sing an Irish song. And this has wonderful words that I really related to, and a beautiful melody. So the words were actually written by William Butler Yeats.
Oh.
Yeah. He put words to an old Irish tune, what he thought would be an appropriate Irish folk song, and has an interesting story right there.
Yeah, all the songs are real special songs from different parts of, you know, the folk music areas like Ireland and Scotland and England and Appalachian Mountains. And it's a really, really, really great record. Yeah.
In Shenandoah, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Shadow.
I actually really, really love that song. I love hearing you sing that song. You want to tell me about how you decided to sing that?
I can't really remember.
No.
Well, it was obvious that he was going to sing a song, whether he liked it or not.
Oh.
Because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the art of the song. He sings a song on that, and it has such pathos.
Wayfair and Stranger.
It's such a beautiful rendition. And Shirley Horn said, Charlie, you just have to sing that song. Uh-huh. And so when it came to doing Rambling Boy, Charlie actually had already chosen Shenandoah. Because, did your mother sing it? Or
We sang it on our radio show.
And, I mean, he sings it. It brings tears to my eyes every time. It's beautiful.
You know, also, Pat Metheny had a big part on this record because he's the one that really called me into doing this. And when he found out I was really going to do it, he said, you know, I want to be there, man. Tell me when's the recording sessions and I'll be there.
He's amazing.
Yeah. He's one of the co-producers along with Mark Fain and Steve Rodby. Yeah. Who's Steve Rodby?
He's the bass player in Pat Metheny's band.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ruth Cameron and Charlie Hayden, for joining Sugar in My Bowl this evening.
Well, thank you, Joy, for having us.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to tell the listeners before you off their computers and phone?
They should just really sit down in a quiet place because, you know, not many people really listen to music anymore. A lot of people have got these little buttons in their ears with the iPods, and it's very sad what's going on in the United States as far as listening to beautiful music, and they should just get with their lover or wife or husband, their family, and go in to where their sound system is and listen to sophisticated ladies and how beautiful it is, and also listen to Jasmine, which is the first time that Keith Jarrett and I played together for 30 years, and it's like we took up where we left off in 1976, you know, and what a great band that was. And so this duet album really reflects that, and they should not miss out on listening to that.
Actually, I have a question with regard to the Hank Jones recording. What's the name of that?
That's called Steal Away.
Okay.
And it's on Verve, and it's something that Hank and I did back in 1996, I think.
Okay.
And we just did another one. Before he passed away, it's going to be called Come Sunday.
That's the one I was wondering about, because you had mentioned this when we were talking about Abby Lincoln in October.
Yeah, and it'll be released sometime this year.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Charlie Hayden and Ruth Cameron.
Bye. Yeah, thanks, WBAI, for still being there.
Yay.
Yes.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
And you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl's name of this program. We got to get out of here for La Nueva Alternativa, but I just wanted to let you know that the Hayden Triplets will be in Brooklyn on Friday, the 25th, at Bell House. You can go to The Bell House, the BellHousenY.com to find out. It's in Brooklyn, this The Bell House, at a very affordable rate. And a group called, what is it, All Boy and All Girl will be opening for them. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.